Welcome everyone. This is the 12th lecture in the course on bhikkhuni ordination held by the Numata Center of Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Women in Buddhist Studies Initiative. Today we have a very special lecture. As you can already see, the lecturer is sitting right beside me. Peter Skilling is going to speak to us on the topic of bhikkhunis in Indian inscriptions. The two of us are here at Stanford. We have both been invited for a conference, and so we are taking this opportunity, sitting here in his hotel room, to do this lecture together. Peter Skilling is a Canadian citizen. He was born in the USA, and he lives now in Thailand. Peter Skilling is a professor at the French School of Asian Studies, based at the center of Bangkok, Thailand. He did his habilitation 2008 at the École pratique des hautes études in Paris and his PhD in 2004 at the École pratique des hautes études in the Sorbonne, Paris. He is an honorary associate of the Department of Indian Subcontinental Studies of the School of Language and Cultures at the Faculty of Arts of the University of Sydney and a special lecturer at the Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok. And the topic he's going to speak to us today is rather important. It counterbalances the other lectures that you have been hearing these days, which were all predominantly based on either textual studies or anthropological research. But now we are moving into quite a different area. We're moving into the area of archaeology and what it can tell us about the history of women and bhikkhunis in ancient India.
Thank you, Venerable Analio. In this talk, as Venerable Analio has said, I will use as my main source for information results of archaeological research in India over a period of well over 100 years, 150 years, during which many inscriptions have come to light. That means records inscribed on stone, recording the donations of Indian society of the time. And of course here I'm going to focus largely on nuns, bhikkhuni, and also on the role of other women in early India. Because Buddhist women, we learn from this evidence, were active participants in the construction of early Buddhism in India. Nuns and lay women were among the sponsors of the monuments, monasteries, and statues of the Buddha across India. In addition, I should mention a collection of verses attributed to nuns, the Terigatha, which is among the earliest documents of female literature in India, or perhaps worldwide. These verses were edited and preserved perhaps about the same time as the earliest of these monuments were constructed. So during this period, from the 3rd century BCE onwards, women played a very significant role in the construction of Buddhism. We do not know a great deal about their lives and their backgrounds. We have no biographies, we have no letters, we have no other documents. But some of the questions that we should think about include, were these women merely donors, or were they also intellectual innovators? Given the large number of inscriptions and the significant participation in the building of monuments, one has to hypothesize that the women were active innovators, active participants in the process of the building of early Indian Buddhism. In this early period, there was what I call the Buddhist building boom. The earliest monuments of India, leaving aside the much earlier Indus civilization in the Sindh or in the Indus Valley, which does not concern us here. The earliest monuments of India are the Buddhist stupas and also cave temples. And many of these, the ones I will largely discuss, were stupas built to house relics, relics of the Buddha, relics of his closest disciples, and relics of later monks. These relics traveled first class across India in processions of stately elephants. You can see the reliquary on the top of the elephant's head in this picture. The shape of the reliquary is the same as some of the actual reliquaries discovered in excavation from stupas. And we can see how this procession of relics is celebrated with music and dance. And incidentally, these inscriptions like this are some of the earliest depictions of music and dance of ancient India. This housing of relics created new landscapes dominated by clusters of stupas and monastic structures, both on the hills and in the plains and valleys. Here you can see a stupa with a woman bringing off offerings and several men celebrating, playing drums. This is a very old stone coping from Vidisha, one of the important early cities of ancient India. One of the donors of this stone coping was a lady named Asaba. We know that from the inscription. In the third century BCE, King Ashoka went on pilgrimage to pay respects to the sites connected with the Buddha. His inscriptions express his deep concern for the welfare of the Sangha, of the Buddhist order, both monks and nuns, as well as for the male and female lay practitioners. This is a stone relief depicting King Ashoka according to a label which you may just be able to see along the top bar above his head and the parasol. An inscribed panel from a newly discovered stupa site in southern India in Karnataka, Kanaganahalli. One site of the Ashokan records is Sarnath, where the Buddha spoke his first sermon in the Deer Park. The Ashokan pillar survives today in a protective shed. And it is broken, but the inscription is largely intact. It can be seen should you have the opportunity to go there. It is in early Brahmi, that is the earliest writing that we have in India, one of the earliest scripts of India. And in this inscription, we can see the words Bhikkhu Sangha and also Bhikkhuni Sangha. So this, from the mid-third century BCE, is one of the earliest preserved records of the existence of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, the order of nuns. And this record is an edict of the king or of the emperor, so that Ashoka, addressed to not only the monastic Sangha, but also to the lay people. It's a public notice, one could say, and it refers to his concern about the breaking up, the division of the Sangha. And especially important for our purposes is that he refers to a monk or nun who shall break up the Sangha should be caused to put on white robes, that means to leave the monastic order, and to reside in non-residence, not to be part of the monastic order. And then he says, this edict must be announced to the Sangha of monks and to the Sangha of nuns. Thus speaks Devanam Priya, the King Ashoka. How were the early stupas built? We do know from the contemporary inscriptions that they were built through collective donation by females and males from many walks of life and sections of society. They were not single projects of kings or members of the court, as seems to have happened in later periods, by which I might say the 4th or 5th century and beyond, and is often implied by the literary records. So here you could say there's a disjuncture between literary records and the reality that we see from the contemporary inscriptions. This great collective effort of the Buddhist communities to find a significant turn in Indian cultural history, not just Buddhist history, at this crucial moment, which is the beginning of built structures and stone art of certain types in India, at this crucial moment, women were among the sponsors and planners, and many of these sponsors were nuns. Some were queens, some were princesses, but the majority were lay followers. This map gives a sampling of the location of Bhikshuni inscriptions in India, and you can see from the map, just very roughly, that they cover a large portion here of northern India, starting from Nepal, in fact, and crossing the continent, coming down to the cave temples along the western part of India. Now, this is one example of the kind of evidence that I'm going to discuss today. We call this a donative inscription. It records a donation. Donative inscriptions give a number of pieces of information. The shortest will give the name of the donor and the object donated. In addition, they'll often give the social status of the donor and sometimes other information like their family relations and their home. Their name of the city or the country in which they live, which shows that the donors, including the nuns, were active across a large area. Here we have the base stone, lower stone of a railing, which is the gift of the nun Sangvahika. This is from Sarnath and is from the 2nd century BC. Now, it's a little controversial, perhaps, the relation between a donation by a nun and the presence of the Bhikshuni or Bhikkhuni Sangha. One single inscription does not make a community. We can therefore suggest, we can therefore say, an inscription like this implies the presence of a Sangha of a community of nuns at Sarnath in the 2nd century BCE. And some of the other inscriptions, many of the other inscriptions, mention more than one nun coming from the same place, or sometimes they mention nuns with their teachers or their disciples. These do give evidence for the active presence any sites in India of the Bhikshuni Sangha. We could start now with the Mahabodhi Temple, the site of the Buddha's awakening, the site of the Bodhi tree. Some of the oldest dedication inscriptions are on the stone pillars there. which formerly encircled the Bodhi tree before the temple was erected, but they were moved, reoriented, and preserved. Now, most of them are in the Bodh Gaya Archaeological Museum. They date to about the 2nd to the 1st century BCE. Many of the railings were sponsored by Arya Kurangi, a queen. This is an early sketch from the 19th century of a relief on one of the pillars that she donated. And this pillar, donated by Kurangi, is one of the few original pillars still kept at the temple, still in the line of pillars surrounding the temple. The other ones are all replicas. This is another example. She donated quite a number of pillars. She's one of the biggest donors of the Bodh Gaya railings. This is another of her pillars in the Bodh Gaya Museum. And this is her inscription, or the inscription carved in her name. So the number of pillars, you can see the size of the rocks of the stone. These are substantial and expensive offerings, showing the wealth, the economic clout of Arya Kurangi. We move on to Sanchi, which is a big complex of stupas in central India near the site that I mentioned, Vidisha. As far as we know, the Buddha himself did not visit Sanchi. However, for reasons we do not really understand, it became a very prominent site. And of course, relics of the Buddha himself were enshrined in Stupa 1 and other stupas. Here is one example. There are dozens of donations by Bhikshunis at Sanchi and at stupas in the area. It shows there must have been a considerable presence of nuns. The word used for nun may be several forms of Prakrit. For example, here we have Bhikshuni. Sometimes there's Bhikkhuni, and I'm generally using the later Sanskrit term Bhikshuni. So here we have Samikaya Bhikshuniya Danam, the gift of the nun Samika. On a crossbar we have Ujjainiya Dhamma Yasaya Matu Bhikshuniya Danam, the gift of the mother of the nun Dhamma Yasa from Ujjaini, an important city in the vicinity or in the same region as Sanchi. So it's important to think about the fact that these are records of historical nuns and historical women. They are not mere literary devices or perhaps fictional records, poetic records. They record the actual deed of women and nuns of that time. Navagamikana upasikana dhamnam, the gift of the female lay worshippers of Navagama. Sanskrit would be Navagrama. So there are collective donations, in this case by women who had undertaken to become lay followers or lay worshippers. The ones I'm showing now are from the 2nd to 1st centuries BCE. Sagarakitaya Koramikaya Vichuni Adam, the gift of the nun Sangha Rakshita, which would be Sangha Rakshita in Sanskrit, a pupil of Kauranika. Kauranika is also a female, and one may assume a nun. So some of these inscriptions record teaching relationships, others, as the one I showed previously, donation of a mother, they show familial relationships. Yakhya Pichuniye Vedi Sadhana, gift of the nun Yakhi from Vedisa, Vedisha. Now this evidence for the activity, the sponsorship of nuns, is not only found at Sanchi Stupa, but in the whole area there are a number of other stupas, many of which have other donative records. One of these is Sattara, which was fairly recently renovated by the Archaeological Survey of India. It is a massive stupa, as big as Sanchi Stupa number 1. It was surrounded by a railing, which at present has not been reconstructed. However, the railing bars and pillars have been preserved. You can see by the way, that these stupas have platforms for circumambulation, for going around the stupa, with stairways leading up to them. One of the main rituals of the early period was the veneration of the stupa, or that is to say, the veneration of the relics, which is to say, the veneration of the Buddha through his relics. Many of the crossbars and uprights of the now dismantled railing were donated by nuns and lay women. Another famous stupa, also in central India, is the Barhut Stupa. It was also a large stupa, and it was surrounded by carved railings. Here too we have dedication inscriptions. This one tells us that the pillars, in the plural, were the gift of the nun Nagila from Mora Giri. So here we have a nun, as these other nuns have had the economic clout, the financial ability to make considerable donations. It shows again that the nuns of that time were participants not only in the Dharma, the practice of the Dharma, or the veneration, but also in the financial sponsorship. And in the box you can see the name of Bhikkhu Ni Nagira. And here is another example of the nun Badika, daughter of Mahamukhi, the Dabinika. These inscriptions give family relations. That is because at that time in India, in fact in present-day India, in fact in much of the world, individuals were not isolated units in society. They were part of families or of social groups. And these relationships were recorded in order to identify them. Here we have gift of the nun Soma from Karkandi. The places named, sometimes some of them we can identify, such as the famous city of Ujjaini, which we have already seen. And many of them are, we do not today know where they are located. Especially interesting is Panguraria in Madhya Pradesh. Ashokan inscriptions were discovered here in about 1976, which reminds me to point out that this data bank, this collection of information, is ongoing. It is changing. New inscriptions are discovered regularly and published sooner or later. We hope sooner, but sometimes many of the ones that I have mentioned to you, like those at Savdara, have not yet been published. And even Ashokan inscriptions, important inscriptions, have sometimes only been discovered quite recently. You can see from this picture that Panguraria, you can see the cave in about the middle of the mountain there, that this inscription, this site is a beautiful natural site. It looks out over the cave where the Ashokan inscriptions are carved and the neighboring stupas. Look over the Narmada Valley. Look over one of the great rivers of India that flows from east to west, from Jabalpur in the east to the sea. It was an important route. Here you see several of the brick stupas, and behind at the top are the rock shelters or natural caves where Ashokan inscriptions were carved. One of the inscriptions is a Western version of Minor Rock Edict 1. Another inscription is a unique inscription. That is to say, the Minor Rock Edicts were carved at royal command across India, but this unique or single inscription records Ashoka's visit to Panguraria, not giving it by that name, as a prince, as a Raja Kumara. So we know that Ashoka in fact came to this site. At the same site, at the larger stupa below the inscriptions, perhaps one of the stupas that you saw a moment ago, there was discovered a parasol staff, that is to say, an umbrella or a sunshade made of stone that was erected to shelter the stupa. This was a practice in India, for it's a royal practice, in fact. Parasols are held above the head of the king, and this custom was transferred to stupas and later to Buddha images. And to donate a parasol to a stupa or to a Buddha image was to gain merit. One of the earliest inscribed parasol staffs is this one from Panguraria. The staff and the stone parasol were found near the largest stupa below the rock shelter. There is a two-line Prakrit inscription which states that this is the donation of Sangha Rahita Bhikshuni, made by her disciple nuns from Karanka Pusa. From Karanka. Their names are Pusa, Dhamma Rahita, and Araha. They had the parasol made. So this is a collective act of a group of nuns at a stupa near the Narmada Valley. The stone parasol today is in storage at the Sanchi Museum. This is a repetition of the previous one. And there is a note that Sangha Rakita and Koramika and Dhamma Rakita are known from inscriptions at Sanchi. Now, what has not been done so far, which I think there is a need, is to make a database of these names of these donations of not only nuns, but also monks or others, a donation, a database of the early donors. If we were to have that, we would have a much better idea of the demography of 2nd to 1st century BCE Indian Buddhism. This is the ribbed stone parasa, a fine piece of work, a very expensive and stately donation. Now we travel to the south and to the east, to the modern Indian state of Maharashtra, where there is a stupa called the Pauni Stupa. It had some carved railings as well. It has been excavated, but the site is encroached by a modern temple, modern Hindu temple, and it is impossible to, at present, for it to be properly excavated. But here you can see a scene from the life of the Buddha, Mucchalido Naga. According to the inscription, and this spelling in the Prakrit of that time and that area, Mucho Rido, we know from Pali as Muchalinda, Naga, the Naga Muchalinda. And the inscription says this was donated by a nun, pupil of Mahayasa. This fine piece is in the National Museum, Delhi. A very important site is Kanna Kanna Hali, Karnataka, which I mentioned earlier. This is a newly excavated stupa. And here too, nuns and laywomen made a big contribution. This large site has been excavated only over the last 20 years and less. And you can see from this cover of the excavation report that it is a large stupa with many fragmentary stone panels. And these are inscribed both with narrative captions describing the event depicted in stone relief and with donative inscriptions in Prakrit. This is a bit later than the other sites we have been looking at. Perhaps it belongs to the first or second century AD. And a massive excavation report has been published very recently, only at the beginning of, or in the middle of last year. However, the treatment of the inscriptions left something to be desired, and they have been edited again with new photographs by a Japanese scholar and edited by Professor Oscar von Hindenburg, retired of Freiburg, one of the great epigraphists, great scholars of Pali and Prakrit. That has just come out. I haven't even seen it yet. But from the existing book, I have a few examples of Kanna Kanna Hali donors. There is the nun Pusa. There is the nun Buima. There is the nun Naguya, who is a disciple of the noble Thera Issa Rakita. So here again we have a teaching lineage, a monastic lineage. And then also we have the nun Vidi, who is pupil of the nun Ima Rakita. The word used here, atewasini in the feminine form, or antewasini in Pali, is specifically a word for a monastic pupil, literally one who lives nearby, lives beside their teacher. So in cases like this, even when the word bhikkhuni does not occur, we can tell from the relationship that this would have been Bhikkhuni. These are some of the Kanaganahalli inscriptions in a later Brahmi script than the ones you've seen earlier. So not only India, but also Sri Lanka was a field for the activities of the early nuns. Here, we do not have donative records on the component parts of stupas, as we have been looking at for India. That is to say, the type of architecture was different, and we do not have these stone railings, generally speaking, and we do not have these many inscriptions numbering in the hundreds that we have in North India. Here we have inscriptions on the ledges above caves, which are basically natural caves, but which were altered and modified as residences for monks and nuns. Here we have a different word, another word which is frequent in Sri Lankan records, shamani or samani, which means a female ascetic, but in this context, again, it has to be a Buddhist ascetic. So this cave is the cave of the nun Tissa, given to the Sangha. And some other examples. Cave of the nun Savira, daughter of Tissa, king of Kanagama, is given to the Sangha. So many of these nuns were elite figures. The same text is given as number 14. And another one, cave of the lay devotee, son of the chief Sumana, is given to the Sangha. An example of an offering by an upasaka, a layman. Here's a rather complicated one. Cave of the Lord Naga, and of Lord Sumana, and of Lord Sumanagupta, and of the female lay devotee, Upasika, Rama, daughter of the chief Datta, is given to the Sangha present and absent. Also of the nun Pala, and of the venerable Dhammagupta. And the description is not complete. This shows a collective donation of elite female figures and also of members of the high society, the elite of that time. The cave of the nun Rohini, daughter of the chief Pashudevala, is dedicated to the Sangha. So here, the caves, the nuns again are the donors, but in this case, largely of caves that were used as residences by the Sangha. The great cave of the nun Naga, daughter of the chief Pusadeva, the commander in chief, is given to the Sangha. So how do we make this corpus, this data base of nuns and early donors that I mentioned? Well, one of the reasons it hasn't been done probably is that it is not easy. The inscriptions that I am referring to have been published over a period of, by now, at least 150 years. They are from sites all over India and also in Sri Lanka. They are published in some cases in books that collect inscriptions. For example, in this case, on early Brahmi inscriptions of Sri Lanka by the great scholar Parinibbana. Others are published in series, like Epigraphia Indica, the corpus of Indian inscriptions, but many others are published in journals, wide range of journals in India and also abroad, and often in rather obscure journals by our standards that most libraries do not have. That is to say, journals of universities or organizations, for example, in Madhya Pradesh or elsewhere, sometimes in Hindi, in the Hindi language. So to collect all of this information is a big task. It is a challenge. We move now to the western caves. That means the caves along the western coastal mountains of India. Some of these were among the earliest inscriptions to be studied in the 19th century in the British colonial period. The British archaeologists and scholars were fascinated by this stone architecture. As you can see, these were massive structures carved in the living rock. And inside there would be monastic cells, rooms for various functions of the Sangha, and stupas and halls for worship. But the pattern of donation of the cave temples is different from that of the great stupas. Single cave shrines, assembly halls, and residences were often sponsored by single donors. Collective sponsorship is not seen in the stupas and chaityas, or does not seem to be recorded in the contemporary inscriptions. This is an example of the interior of such caves. You have long pillared galleries with a stupa at the end. In the later periods, such as the famous Ajanta caves, the stupa might also have a Buddha image carved on it, or even in many halls, there was a shrine for a large Buddha image. And so now we come to Buddha Rupa, Buddha Patima, the image or statue of the Buddha. So exactly when or where the first image of the Buddha was produced is unknown. We do know that some of the earliest colossal stone images were produced at Mathura in northwestern India along the major trade route. It's a very significant city. They were produced by monastics, so that is to say sponsored by monastics belonging to the Sarvastivadin order of monks. Dedicatory inscriptions reveal a group of learned monks and nuns connected by teacher-disciple relationships who sponsored images along the Yamuna River Valley. So these inscriptions and these images themselves show, again, a collective attitude towards donation in which, in this case, monks, nuns, and their relatives as well, join together to sponsor the construction of Buddha images and the placement of them in significant sites along the Yamuna River Valley. So once again we meet with collective donation. Once again we meet with teaching lineages, some of which you will see are really quite significant. But these are lineages about which we know little. We do not know their long durée. We know only what one or two inscriptions tell us. And beyond that, we do not know anything about these monks and nuns. These are kind of snapshots of donative practices involving Sangha in early India. Now we're coming into the Kushana period, and that is to say into the 1st, 2nd, 3rd centuries CE. These are large images. You can see this is over 1 meter in height. It's an image dedicated by Bhikshuni Buddha Mitra, the Tripitaka master, during the reign of Kanishka. Let's say the Kushana period. This image is at Kaushambi, an urban center right on the Yamuna River. So we see that this Bhikkhuni, Buddha Mitra, was a Tripitaka. That term means someone who has mastered the Buddhist canon, the Tripitaka. That is to say, she was a scholar. This is a pedestal of an image from Bhikshuni Buddhamitra from the Goshitarama, one of the early monasteries, which is mentioned in the Sutra Pitaka at Kaushambi. So you would see from those pictures, those slides, that in the case of the images, the donative inscriptions are generally carved on the base. Unfortunately, the fate of the images many centuries later, or 1,000 years later and more, was not a happy one. Now, as Buddhism began to decline, to weaken, to die out in northern India, the monasteries, the nunneries, were abandoned and left to their own fate, which meant the images would be damaged by natural forces and also later on by iconoclasts and others. So many, many of them are now broken, and in many cases we possess only the base, only the inscription. The image of the Buddha himself no longer survives. This massive image does survive. This is very well known in the history of Buddha images. The standing Buddha erected by Bhikshu Pala, who, according to the inscription, was a Sarvastivadin Tripitaka master. And we have found so far 2 images made by Bhikshu Pala. And one of them at least has a sheltering parasol. And that was found at Shravasti. And 2 more were found at Sarnath. So Bhikshu Pala, again a scholar. So we should note that the scholar monks, and here in this case Sarvastivadin monks, Tripitaka masters, were intimately connected with the early Buddha images. And Bhikshuni Buddha Mitra, just mentioned, was a pupil of Bhikshu Pala. And Bhikshuni Buddha Mitra had a disciple named Bhikkhuni Dhanavati. So here we have 3 names in this teaching relationship, a monk, a nun, and her disciples. And here we have only, again, the inscribed base of an image in Mathura. Another Bhikshuni at Mathura was Uddadasi Bhikshuni. Her name means the servant or the slave of the Buddha. She erected this image for the benefit and happiness of all beings. Sarva Satvanam Hitta Sukhaye. This is a common theme on not only Buddha images, but also on stupas or other structures donated by the faithful. They did this to benefit all beings. Another example, Bhikshuni Pusahatina and Bhikshuni Buddhadeva from about the 2nd century BCE. And here we have Bhikshuni Buddhadeva's image of the seated Buddha, again dedicated for the welfare and the happiness of beings. The standing Buddha, in this case dedicated by Nupasika, a female lay disciple. The surviving portion of a large standing image of the Blessed One, the incomparable Sakyamuni, dedicated by Upasika Kwavisha. This is from Mathura in red sandstone. These samples that I have been showing here reveal the significant role in the early art of India played by female sponsors, both nuns and Upasika. So they have collaborated with the monks and with the craftsmen of the time to create images which even today remain celebrated for their power and their beauty. Now, another important area of Buddhist practice, Buddhist development, was Gandhara, which is now in Pakistan, largely in the area of modern Pakistan and Afghanistan. Donatory inscriptions of nuns in Gandhara are rare. There are inscriptions of monks, and more frequently, perhaps in Gandhara, there are donations made by members of the court, princes and kings and queens. But here is one example. This is written in Kharoshthi, a different alphabet from the Brahmi we have been seeing so far, and a script used in the northwest of India. According to the inscription in Kharoshthi, this reliquary from what is now Hazara District, Pakistan, was donated by Bhikshuni Uttara. And here is a gilded schist reliquary from Swat in Pakistan, and it contained an inscribed gold plate as well as golden flowers and jewelry. The gold plate bears a long inscription recording the meritorious deeds of King Sainavarma, addressed to the twofold community that has assembled. And that can only mean the presence that they have assembled, the presence of the community of monks and the community of nuns. So although we do not have many donated inscriptions, many records of actual nuns in Gandhara, we do have a few very interesting pieces that show the presence of nuns. And we have to remember that the records that I'm showing you are fragmentary. They are, many of them are discovered by accident. Fewer are discovered in actual excavation. Many of them are broken, incomplete, so we can gain only partial information of what they were meant to say. And many have been dug up or looted and have gone abroad, and where they have ended up in private collections and in museums. So once again, we have a very scattered and incomplete record So I'm showing you some of the examples I have found. This is a Buddha image donated by a nun, but I'm afraid that the caption seems to have vanished. Ah, here it is. Bronze Buddha dedicated by Shakya Bhikshuni Parishuddhamati at Namgwal Monastery in CE 539 in Nepal. It is believed to come from either Nepal or eastern Uttar Pradesh in India. This means from the 7th century. For the later period, we do not have so many images, but it is also fair to say that by the Pala period, by the 8th, 9th century and beyond, the practice of inscribing, the practice, the inscriptional practice, had changed. For many centuries already, we no longer have these collective acts of donation to build stupas, so we no longer have the inscriptions that we had at, for example, Sanchi. We do have inscriptions on images, stone images, usually on the base. Here is a Tara from Kukihar in Bihar, dedicated by Shakya Bhikshuni Unamati. In Madhya Pradesh, we have several Buddha images from Popdar, and this fine image of a bronze standing image was dedicated by Vidyadhara Swamini, mother of a member of the royal family of the Pratiharas. Here we do have Bhikshuni inscriptions of this later period. We will show some. But there are also female donors continued to be active. It's also from Bihar. These are substantial images. Again, we find female donors contributing significantly to Indian art and Indian iconography. The inscription is on the base. An extremely fine Singhamada Lokeshwara, dedicated by Shakya Stavira Vijaya Sri Bhadra. That is to say, in this case, this is by a senior monk who has donated this image. So we do also have some inscriptions. So I think I will leave it at that, and I hope this has been of interest to you. And I hope that there will be people who will follow this up more seriously than I have been able to do, and to tell us more, help us to learn more about the early Bhikshunis and the later Bhikshunis from the historical records themselves.